Let me in the book of Deuteronomy. I'll start there. Deuteronomy chapter number 17. Deuteronomy chapter number 17. And I don't know that I'm going to cover any new ground. If you've been here on a while back, we went through a couple years ago or so. We went through a bunch of, on Wednesday nights, went through a bunch of the history of the kings of Israel, and we covered some of what I want to cover today. I know it's come in. I don't know that I've ever featured it in a lesson or in a sermon, but I was actually did basically this same the same idea this past Thursday for the school up here on their chapel. So it's not going to be nearly as entertaining as the way I do it for them, just to warn you. But we're going to cover a lot of ground, probably about 90% groundwork and about 10% sermon by the time we're all done. So hopefully you learn something, hopefully you'll be able to apply something. But I want to talk about the king who struck out, the king who struck out. I thought it was a good title myself. It's baseball season. So the king who struck out. Now, what we're going to open reading is Deuteronomy chapter number 17. And we'll build from there. So Deuteronomy chapter number 17, beginning in verse number 14. Now, remember, this is God. He's talking to Moses. This is laying down the law. Okay, this is part of the old, you know, Mosaic law. So just remember where we're at here. When thou art come unto the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shalt possess it, and shalt dwell therein, and shalt say, I will set a king over me, like as all the nations that are about me. Thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother. But he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to the end that he should multiply horses. For as much as the Lord hath said unto you, ye shall henceforth return no more that way. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away, neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. And it shall be, when he sitteth upon the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write him a copy of the law in a book out of that which is before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, to keep all the words of this law and these statutes, to do them, that his heart be not lifted up above his brethren, and that he turn not aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, to the end that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. It's a remarkable passage. You know, you can go all the way back to at least Genesis 17:6 and see that God promised there would be kings come out of Israel. God promised Abraham there, I will make thee exceeding fruitful and will make nations of thee, and kings shall come out of thee. Well, that was even before this, but right here, as Moses is writing these words, Israel has no king. They're right on the verge, they're preparing to go into the promised land, and God tells them, now, when you get into the land, when you are secure in that land, here's what's going to happen. There's a little bit of a prophecy here. It says, here's what's going to happen. You're going to want a king. That nation is going to say, we want a king. And by the way, he tells us the very reason. They want to be like the nations around them. If you fast forward, about 350 years later, the people came to Samuel in 1 Samuel 8:5, and this is what they said, now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. 350 years before, God says, you're going to demand a king, and here's the reason why, and it plays out exactly like God says. Now, you think, well, yes, there was a rejection of God. I don't want to get into all that, but realize God works through this. God's going to use that. Through that royal line that will be established, the Messiah would someday come. He would be the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. But before Christ could come to rule and reign, there would be an earthly kingdom of Israel. In our text, I identify five different rules that the new that the king of Israel was supposed to do. I kind of simplify this bullet down to five things. Number one, the king should be an Israelite. There in verse number 15, one from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. Thou shalt, mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother. Now, honestly, that's really never an issue in the Old Testament. The men who will hold the throne may not always be of David's line, but they are all of the DNA of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The only problem you get into with that is when you get to the New Testament and King Herod, who's an Edomite. But for the Old Testament period, that's really not an issue, okay? The second one, do not multiply horses. But he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to turn to Egypt. To the end, they shall multiply horses, okay? Now, this is not just good financial advice, okay? That's not what, what he's talking about here. But horses in the Old Testament world are used for one thing and one thing only, and that is war. There's a reason why. I mean, why of all animals? He could have said, don't have cows, don't have what? And he says, don't have horses. Why? Or don't multiply horses. Because this is talking about building up a great army. You say, well, why such a big deal? We need them. I mean, I'm all for heaven. I want America to have a big, bad, strong army. I don't want people messing with us. I want deterrence through strength. You know, why can't they do that? Because the king is supposed to trust in the Lord, not supposed to trust that he's got this huge, powerful army. He's supposed to trust in the Lord for his protection. The third thing, do not multiply wives. And this, by the way, this gets misconstrued a little bit. This is not about passion or lust, I think. Marriages involving royalty have been used in making treaties and agreements as long as somebody came up with a terrible idea of having royalty. You secure good relations with, you know, this country because you marry your princess to their prince, and now we're all one big happy family. We won't attack each other. I mean, go read the history of Europe. That's the way it works. And I mean, go read Queen Victoria. We're going to marry everybody. Half the continent's related to Queen Victoria eventually, and some of those, you know, things that go on. But I believe what this is, again, is God wanting the king to trust in him and not trust in all these alliances. I think that's the primary thing in there. Number four, do not multiply wealth. And by the way, it's not a new truth. Paul wrote in 1 Timothy 6:10, the love of money is the root of all evil. That'll pull your heart away. But again, this is God wanting the king to trust in him and not his bank account, not the stockpile of gold, not whatever he has in his Fort Knox. He wants him to trust in him. And then number five, the king's supposed to have his own copy of the law to study. You know, not everybody could afford to pay scribes, because remember, back in this day, it's not you just go over to the printer and pop one out. This is somebody has to hand copy all of that, and it's very meticulous work. It takes, months and months and months to put together a good copy. And but a king could afford this, and this was a king who was supposed to have their own study Bible, if you will, to know what God said. And it's vitally important that he dwell in God's word to guide his heart and his mind. Now, I will say on this one, there's really no evidence. I can't say when God gives his opinion of the kings and says, you know, this one served him, this one didn't. It never says this guy had a copy of the Bible, this guy didn't. I can't tell you. I can tell you the ones I suspect didn't. They're pretty obvious. But I don't really know on this one who did and who didn't. So just throwing that out there, because what I want to do, these five criteria I think you can use to measure the rule of a king in the Bible. Did they do these five things? Now, today I want to look at one of the greatest kings in Israel's history, and I want to see how he fared by these. He was certainly an Israelite, so that number one's not an issue. And like I say, the number five, I don't know if he had his own copy of the Bible. He probably did. I would assume he did, but we're just going to leave that off the table. I want to focus on those middle three. The three rules. Do not multiply horses or build up a massive army. Do not multiply wives. I think that's alliances. and do not multiply wealth. Now, if you'll forgive me, as I was putting this together, you know, I've been watching the Rangers. They need to get their act together a little bit. But I've got baseball in my mind. It's spring. Hope springs eternal every spring for your baseball team, you know. But I was thinking about this, and so here we go. One, two, three. Three pitches. Three strikes, if you will. We're going to find out if this king strikes out when we throw these three pitches at him. So up to the plate steps our batter. His name is Solomon. We first read of him back in 2 Samuel chapter number 7. And God knew he was coming. God knew he was going to work through him. He prophesied about before his birth in 2 Samuel 7. David had a desire to build the temple, but God said, no, no, David, you can't do it. Too much blood on your hands. If David did it, it would have been a monument to David and his conquering. God wouldn't allow that. But God instead gives David what we call the Davidic covenant. It's a series of promises God pledges to keep. And just quickly, 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse number 12 says, and when thy days, talking to David, your days, when you're dead, thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, I, God, will set up thy seed after thee. So you're going to have a son continuing on the throne, which shall proceed out of thy bowels. I take that to mean he hasn't been born yet. That's an interesting little note there. And I will establish his kingdom. Verse 13, he shall build an house for my name. He's the one that's going to build the temple. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father. He shall be my son. If he commit iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men. But my mercy shall not depart away from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before thee. I love that. Basically say, look, he's going to go off course, but I'm not going to totally reject him like I did Saul. Even though he deserves it, I'm not going to do that. Verse number 16, and thy house and thy kingdom shall be established forever before thee. Thy throne shall be established forever. This is God telling David what's going to happen with Solomon. Solomon is the next link in that chain to bring about the Messiah, David's royal line. He, through Solomon, the kingdom will be established. And that's what we're looking at right here. That son, Solomon, is born to David and Bathsheba in 2 Samuel chapter number 12. They name him Solomon, which basically means peaceful, man of peace. The prophet Nathan gives him another name, calls him Jedidiah, which means beloved of the Lord. And like I said, I think he's marked to be the successor for a lot of different reasons that I don't have time to get into. But if you study out the life of David, you'll know that after his sin with Bathsheba, things get a little rough in his reign. Those final years are particularly rough. There's much trouble in the household, and a lot of that's because he's fractured it because of his sin with Bathsheba. The lowest point is probably where his son Absalom tries to take the throne. Solomon's about 12 years old when that happens, and they have to run out of Jerusalem and leave. They have to fight a battle to retake the throne. Then about a year before David's passing, one of his other sons, Adonijah, tries to take the throne. And Nathan and Bathsheba, they have to get David and say, get him to act. And so he officially proclaims Solomon to be the successor. He's anointed to be the king. For about a year, they co-ruled together. Solomon's 20 years old at the time. After David's passing, he still has to deal with plots against him. At the beginning of his reign, we read in 1 Kings 3 that God appeared to him at Gibeah. He went to Gibeah, that's where the tabernacle was, to offer sacrifices. And God appeared to him, and I've always thought about it. He says, I'll give you, what do you want? I'll give you anything you want. Boy, that's a dangerous question, isn't it? But they asked Solomon, what do you want? And you see Solomon's heart at this time. He says, I want wisdom. I want wisdom so I can be a good king. Because he's looking at this. He's 20 years old, this great kingdom. He's been coming through some turmoil here. He says, how in the world can I make it? I need some wisdom. God, I need some help. You can see his heart at this time through this. God replies, and by the way, I'm just going to use 1 Kings. I'm not going to use the parallel stuff in Chronicles. So all my references, you can find extra references too. But 1 Kings chapter number 3, God responds, Behold, I have done according to thy words. Lo, I have given thee a wise and an understanding heart, so that there was none like thee before thee, neither after shall any arise like unto thee. And I also have given thee that which thou hast asked, both riches and, or hast not asked, sorry, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be any among the kings like unto thee all thy days. Verse 14 is important. And if thou wilt walk in my ways to keep my statutes and my commandments, as thy father David did walk, then I will lengthen thy days. He says, if you will follow me, it's going to be a lot better for you. We go on. We read about the spectacular growth and fame of Solomon and his kingdom. We read of the great building projects, most important of which is the temple, the first temple, Solomon's temple. I'm convinced the most beautiful building ever built. I wish we could have seen it in all its glory. I think Solomon did a good job for about the first half of his reign. Not without problems, he's a human. But I think the first half of his reign goes pretty good. And after 20 years, God appears to him again at Gibeah. In 1 Kings chapter number 9, God delivers this message, beginning in verse number 4. And if thou wilt walk before me as David thy father walked, in integrity of heart and in uprightness, and do according to all that I have commanded thee, and will keep my statutes and my judgments, then I will establish the throne of thy kingdom upon Israel forever, as I promised to David thy father, saying, there shall not fail thee a man upon the throne of Israel. But, verse 6, but if ye shall at all turn from following me, ye or your children, and will not keep my commandments and my statutes, which I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then will I cut off Israel out of the land which I have given him, and his house which I have hallowed for my name will I cast out of my sight, and Israel shall be a proverb and a byword among the people. Again, the choice is laid out. Solomon, I've given you wisdom, I've given you wealth. What are you going to do with it? Are you going to serve me? Is your heart going to stay true? Solomon, the wisest man who ever lived, had the same two choices we have. You realize we have the same two choices. We can serve God and we can enjoy the blessings that only he can give. Or we can rebel against him, but we're going to pay the price. We're going to face judgment for going the wrong way. So if you will, back to baseball in my mind here. Here comes King Solomon. He's coming up to the plate. Never thought about it, but the whole time I've been picturing as a lefty. I don't know why. But here comes Solomon, and Bill, appreciate that one. But he's a lefty, and he gets up there. So here's the pitcher. Now, we're going to throw three pitches to him. We got three rules. Remember back there from Deuteronomy, there's three things we're going to throw at him. Some of y'all already piecing this together, okay? Let's see how he handles these. The pitch number one, do not multiply horses. Don't build up the big army. Here's the windup in the pitch. And then we turn over to 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 26. And Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen, and he had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, whom he bestowed in the cities for chariots and with the king at Jerusalem. Swing and a miss, strike one. He missed the ball on that one. He definitely built up quite the army. He was relying a lot. And by the way, that's a peacetime army. That wasn't a necessity army when he's doing that. By the way, let me throw this out there. Like I said, I told you a lot of this is background, but we're going to have a little bit of application here. How often do we fail that ourselves? Well, it's not horses, but literally. But how often do we trust in our own strength, our own wisdom, our own power, our own authority? Well, I'm the boss, nobody can tell me what to do, you know. Whatever that case may be, how often do we rely in our own human powers and our own strength? When true success is relying on him whose strength is infinite, whose wisdom is infinite. That's where true peace, true victory comes in, is when we follow him and not rely on our own power. Solomon fails this pitch, and by the way, I'm afraid that's a, I don't know what you would call that, that's a screwball or something there, curveball. We all struggle with that one, I'm afraid. We like to do things in our own power. Psalm 20, verse number 7, his father David wrote these words, "Some trust in chariots, some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God." By the way, if I had time this morning, we could go through the Old Testament, and I could show you time after time after time after time where a great big army shows up, and for miraculous reasons, 300 guys with trumpets and jars, or God just confounds them and something happens. I can show you plenty of times where giant armies just dissolve before the power and the might of God. That's no big deal to him. Trust in his strength. Trust in his strength and not our own. It's time for the second pitch. We don't have the pitch clock on here, so we don't have to keep it going. You know, anyway. Pitch number two. Do not multiply wives. I figured there'd be some snickers on that one already. Here's the windup and the pitch. Turn over to 1 Kings chapter number 11, verses 3 and 4. "And he," Solomon, "had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For it came to pass when Solomon was old that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father." You ever seen a batter swing so hard their helmet flies off and they fall down? I think that's what Solomon does on this one. Like, you know, getting mixed up, thought it was a breaking ball and it was a fastball or something, and they just come out of their shoes swinging. That's, you know, what I have in my mind here. It's Steroch too, and it's obvious. There's no sense in doing the appeal of the pitch now. You can challenge the pitches. No need to do that. This is obvious. To say Solomon failed this command is like saying the Grand Canyon is just a hole in the ground. By the way, I heard an old preacher say once that Solomon may have been the wisest man on earth, but he wasn't the smartest. Having that many mother-in-laws, I say that. I love my mother-in-law. I do. My mother-in-law's awesome. But I remind you again, I don't believe this is about passion or anything like that. Listen, there's other things you can do with that, but I think this is about politics. I think this is about treaties. He was making treaties with all his neighbors. Like, "Hey, you down there, Edom," or whatever, you know, little country down there. Like, "Hey, we'll be friends now. We'll sign an agreement. We'll have some trade. I'll trade some gold, buy some of your food. We'll make a deal, and we'll seal the deal. I'll marry your daughter." Sold. That's a good deal. Now they're allied with this big, powerful, rich country. I think that's what's going on in this. He was making treaties with neighbors and all the enemies and all the powers to benefit himself. Again, I would ask, do we not do the same? Hopefully not the marriage thing. But instead of trusting God when we're in distress, is the first words you have, do you call to heaven or do you pick up your phone because you know the person who owes you a favor? You know the person that, "Hey, you helped me out last time. I'm in a bind. I need some help." How many of us, the first place we go is not to the Lord, if we're honest with ourselves? Instead of trusting God, we rely on others. By the way, if you haven't realized it yet, earthly friends will let you down. I'm looking out. I think all of y'all are old enough to understand that. But there is one person in this universe that will never fail you. We need to rely on Him. Rely on God. Don't rely on our connections and our, I know so-and-so. I didn't. Boy, he owes me. That'll get you in trouble because you're not relying on God. By the way, you're relying on your own strength and your own plans and your own little web of things there, like a spider almost. You got to be careful with that. By the way, then you start doing things not for the goodness of other people, but because, hey, you know, I'm invested, so sometimes they can pay me back. And that's not the way you do things, okay? Trusting God. Trusting God. And the third thing, pitch number three. Solomon's back, batter's box, gets the cleats down in there real good. You know, here comes the payoff pitch. The windup, throw. Do not multiply wealth. Do not multiply wealth. 1 Kings chapter number 10, verse 23. So King Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and for wisdom. Go down to verse number 27. And the king made silver to be in Jerusalem as stones, and cedar made he to be as the sycamore trees that are in the vale for abundance. Basically, there's so much gold, nobody wants silver. There's no need for it. Silver was kind of the backup. You know, if you can't afford gold, you get silver. But when everybody can afford gold, there's no market for silver. The price, I mean, imagine that. You're like walking down the road. I mean, I'm getting to the point now. If I'm like Walmart parking lot and there's a penny on the ground, used to like, hey, man, I'm a penny close to being a millionaire. That's what I used to think. Now I look at it and say, is that really worth it? I don't know. Wear and tear on the body. I don't think it's worth it picking that thing up. They're not worth what they used to be anymore. We're good for that. But that's the way it was. I mean, think about this kingdom. It's like, that's just a chunk of silver. Man, I got plenty of gold at home. I don't need that. It's hard to even think about that, the things being that wealthy. You could walk by and see a gemstone and be like, yeah, I've got 12 of them. That's how just unbelievably wealthy this kingdom was at the time. Cedar trees, I think of great big redwoods when I think about that, but the prettiest trees, and it's just like all the mesquite trees over here taking over a field. I mean, it's like, well, who cares? We got plenty of those. The descriptions of his wealth are absolutely astounding. The amount of gold, it was 666 talents of gold came in every year. It's an interesting number. Make of that what you will. But you do the math, that is 25 tons of gold. We're not even measuring that in ounces or pounds. Tons of gold. Exotic trade goods from all over the world. I would say he swings and he misses on this one also. Strike three, he is out. Now, again, before we start pointing fingers at Solomon, especially, I'm going to tell you, in our day and age, in America, do we not do the same? Do we not do the same? We live in the greatest, most prosperous nation this world has ever seen. We throw away more food than some people eat in a day. I actually saw a deal. They did a study. They went over, it was in the United Kingdom. Just this past week, this was in the headlines. They went over and they did a survey. And they asked, they listed out all 50 states, United States, and they asked the people of the UK where the United Kingdom would fit in terms of, and it was GDP per capita, but basically wealth index, okay? How wealthy is the United Kingdom compared to the 50 United States? Where would you place it? Most of them placed it, I think, on average, like 6th or 7th on the list, putting, you know, like New York, California, Texas, you know, some of the states above it. But on average, they said, the survey said they put it 6th or 7th. And listen, Britain's a prosperous country. They've got a lot of wealth, too. I mean, I'd say the standard of living is pretty high over there. Here's the truth, though. Do you know where the United Kingdom would rank if we were to use its GDP per capita versus the 50 United States? 51st. 51st. That's how prosperous our nation is. It's unbelievable. But you know what our abundance has done? It's made us lose our trust in God. I marvel, we're saying, I love the old Heavenly Highways, but I love these songs that are written out of like the Great Depression. People who had nothing, people who had to trust God. They don't know where their next meal's coming from. There's not a government program to help them. If that crop fails, they don't know what they're going to do. Those people learned how to have tremendous faith in God. Us, we have a lot of faith in MasterCard and Visa. When something comes up, we'll take care of it. We'll pay for it. We'll do it later. But how often do we really trust in the riches of God? The God who owns everything. He owns the cattle on a thousand hills, the hills and the taters in the hills, as the old preacher said. He owns it all, but we like to take our little minuscule little thing and say, God, I got this, God, don't worry. Let me swipe my little card here. We're good. And I'm not just picking on credit cards. We could do this a lot of different things. But there's so many things we rely on our own wealth when we ought to be trusting in God. We've been robbed of that ability by our prosperity. And by the way, I'm afraid if God wants to turn America back to Him, that's where it's going to take place. I've told y'all, God, when God wants to kill a Baptist, He doesn't shoot him in the head or the heart. He shoots him in the pocketbook. That's the deadly blow. And I think that's where He's going to have to get our attention. We're going to have to get to the point we have to learn how to trust Him again. So musicians come. I'm going to wrap this up with a quick statement here. We've seen God's commands for the kings of Israel to follow. We've seen how Solomon failed, and failed mightily in all three of these things. He, like I said, struck out. God sent, and you keep on reading, God sent opposition to him, and there's enemies that come up the last few years of his life. There's a lot of turmoil. He dies at 60. What you think about as rich and as powerful and as advanced as his kingdom was, you think 60, that's not that old anymore, is it? No, it's not that old anymore. But it wasn't that old for him. His father fought in wars and everything else, died at 70. He was a very broken man. Other kings are going to live a lot longer. You would have expected his reign to be longer, but he dies at 60. I think God took him home early. But I want to close with the challenge that he closed his life with. He writes three books of the Bible. You have Song of Solomon. I think that's about his very first marriage, written right before he became king, probably. He writes the book of Proverbs. I think most of that's written at the height of his power. But then he writes the book of Ecclesiastes at the close of his life. When he looks back over all the decisions that he has made in his life, all the choices. And here's how the book ends. Ecclesiastes chapter number 12, verses 13 and 14. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment and every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. You can't get away from God's... You know, what God writes in this, this isn't just helpful hints, suggestions. He knows what we need. He knows our tendencies. He knows our weaknesses. He knew the kings would struggle in the areas of warfare and wealth and the wives and all that. He knew they would struggle. That's why he had those provisions in there. We can learn a lot from them. We can learn a lot because we're humans too. We have the same foibles, the same weaknesses. The best of men are still men at best. So I hope that we can learn from King Solomon just a few different things where, oh, maybe he thought he could do it a little bit better. Maybe he thought he was an exception. Maybe he thought, well, God's, you know, listen, God did bless him. I won't take that away from him. But all these things work to turn his heart away from God. And if we're not careful, we'll let the things of this world do that to us too. And I would add to this, most important thing, I heard an interview, I think it was Mark Cuban, and they asked him, well, what do you think, what matters when you get to the end of life? Is it, you know, he who has the most toys wins? And he's like, oh, I don't know, but he kind of blustered and had a different answer, but thought to myself, how many people are playing that game? You know, my bank account, I'm a success. My bank, you know, the only thing that matters in this world is whether or not you know Christ. That's the number one thing. And I'm going to tell you, I think if you could get Solomon, I think number one he'd say is you need Christ. Number two, he would be, you need to serve him. Listen to what he says. Follow God. It starts with knowing him as your Savior. Oh, and what number there?
85
there in the, we're still back in the Heavenly Highway. So if you'll stand, if you want to sing along with the invitation hymn, number 85 in the blue books. Let's have a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, I thank you so much for this day. I thank you for the lessons we can learn in the Old Testament. We learn so vividly from the accounts of other people's lives and choices, from their victories, but also from their mistakes. And Lord, as we examine the life of Solomon, we marvel at his greatness. We marvel at how you mightily used him. But Lord, even the greatest among us can fall. And we highlighted three of the key reasons that his heart did drift, especially in those later years. I pray that it's a warning to us to stay with our faith fully in you, not in our own power, not in our own wealth, not in our own wisdom, but fully trusting in you. I pray that this simple truths that we've looked at, find a resting place in our hearts and be a reminder to us when we're tempted to turn our attention, our hearts, and our hope and our strength back to you. Challenge us in this invitation time, I pray in thy holy name. Amen.